Welcome to this week's Two Men in the Middle. This is where two men from the middle of the country get together and talk politics and current affairs. I'm Craig Huey.
I'm Brandon Kinnig.
So we're a little bit late on this podcast. We've been doing really good with keeping on a weekly Thursday roll, but
we missed a week.
Work has a tendency to get in the way for the amateur podcaster.
So yes, that's it does. This is not our full-time job, just everybody listening, in case you wonder.
If everybody out there wants to do some sort of sponsorship where Brandon and I could make this our full-time job, I think we could find a way to work that out.
I think so. We're completely open. And send us your ideas.
I think for an initial investment of $250,000, we could be off and running. Yeah. We could rent some studio time.
Agreed.
I've always threatened, and I can't figure out how to do this, is how do we record, how do we film this so we could start a YouTube channel?
Oh, yeah.
But that requires all video equipment, and that sounds
coordination, yeah,
way more complicated than the 25 minutes a week we put into preparing for this conversation.
It does. Now, that's a long-term thing, and that's after we get that initial investment.
True.
Then we go there.
True. So for your initial investment in the pod, it would enable us to go video, which would be next level for us.
Exactly.
So I think we've gained some context now to the end of the Kavanaugh situation. That all has come to a close. As we were warming up, it's like I don't want to beat on this anymore. It feels like we've kind of touched on this and like everybody has really talked about as much as you can about this. I do want to say I listened to our last pod, and I thought the pod that we did on Kavanaugh was just as good as any other national pod or national podcast. I thought our takes and our interpretation on things were on par with anything else you're gonna hear on the web in this format.
Right. I heard similar reviews, and I think, I mean, we covered every angle of it too. I mean, it was pretty in-depth. It wasn't, you know, one side or one facet of the issue.
So the one thing I want to clean up from my last performance on the pod, because I listened to these three or four times just to kind of hear myself and hear what I think and am I making sense. At one point in time, I said something that sexual assault wasn't totally a man's problem. I think what I was trying to say there is fixing sexual assault isn't all on men. Sexual assault is 100% a male problem. It's a male issue that males need to fix. There's never a response where sexual harassment or sexual assault is appropriate.
Right.
I think I was trying to say was, if we're going to fix this,
reducing it,
reporting it, fixing it, that's on all of us. So I did, somebody did listen to that and say, it gave me some feedback. Like, did you really mean to say that? I'm like, I think that came out a little bit wrong.
Well, and just from the perspective of being able to gain justice for the survivors, I mean, being able to make others aware of it when it happens is necessary, because it's much more difficult to get justice further away from the actual event, and that's just the way it is. And so we got to empower everybody to come forward as soon as possible when it happens and to be comfortable with that.
So it became clear sometime middle-ish of last week that Kavanaugh was going to get confirmed.
Right.
What I thought earlier in the week,
the FBI investigation didn't really introduce anything.
And everybody, I think, kind of knew, unless somebody new came forward or they greatly expanded the initial scope of what they were doing, that was going to be the conclusion of the FBI investigation. What I thought one possible outcome could be is that some combination of Corker, Flake, Murkowski, or Collins, two of them voted no. They would wash Kavanaugh out. Trump still declares victory because, look, I nominated the conservative judge everybody wanted. I stuck with him the whole way. I didn't back down. It gives him something to kind of rally about in the midterms by saying, hey, look what the Dems did.
Right.
If you don't want this to happen again and they're trying to hold the court, we got to make sure we hold the Senate and you got to hold them off in the House as well. But that didn't happen.
And I think if he would have been voted down, I think that would have been more of a turnout incentive for his base than him being voted
in. I think so.
Because it would have been anger that they could have fueled into turnout at the midterms and, you know, avenging Kavanaugh. I mean, they could have had messaging around that. I think that's much more difficult to do now because, you know, they won. So that's not as effective as a message, unlike on the Democratic side where it can be used to fuel turnout.
I thought that would be the best political calculation for the Republicans.
Right.
But not only did only Murkowski vote no, and I read a story that she was visited by dozens of women who came from Alaska to talk to her about, you know, their experience with sexual assault and that really, really kind of impacted and weighed on her. I was surprised that not only did Susan Collins vote yes, then she gave a speech where she gave a rounding endorsement of that vote. She didn't hedge her bet. She didn't back away from it. She didn't give a soft yes. She came out and gave an absolute I'm a yes. Then she went even farther in the media.
It's a very long speech.
That said, I don't believe Kavanaugh assaulted Ford. I don't believe that happened.
She says she believes that Ford was assaulted, but not by Kavanaugh.
That was weird, too. I was having a hard time trying to figure out, you know, one angle is that's just what she believes, and she stood up strongly for what she believes in. And there should be more of that in politics. But you always have to try to calculate, too, what is the political cost and what is the political angle for this? Susan Collins, when she got elected to the Senate, said she'd serve two terms. I have a strong belief Susan Collins is not running for the Senate again.
Well, that'll be interesting to see. You know, she was contemplating a run for governor and decided against that, I think, earlier this year. And then, you know, there was, during the context of this vote, there was a whole crowdfunding effort, you know, basically to raise money for an opponent if she voted the wrong way. And the whole idea was this started before the vote, with the caveat that if she voted against him, the money would be returned. So it was all based on that. So now you have this pool of money. I mean, significant.
I think it's up to like $4 million.
Yeah. You know, that's been raised to find an opponent. And there's already been, you know, talk of that. And so I think that that may have just, you know, kind of solidified her position. I think she may have been like, you know, I'm just going to even, you know, be more direct. And I think that's caused her to go in that direction. I wouldn't be surprised to see her step down, though. I think that, you know, it's, she's in a very difficult position going into that, because this may have helped her too with Trump's base. But at the same time, conservatives have not been fans of hers. And so I don't know if it's enough to keep her from still having a primary endorsement if she were to still run.
Well, she carried her state with over 60% of the vote the last time she
won. That's true, yeah.
So she is a strong candidate. That if Dems, if you think you're going to go after Susan Collins, that's not a layup. That's a pretty hard sell.
So her and the former moderate Republican Senator Olympia Snowe had both won with, you know, convincing margins. I mean, and have. And so, you know, and Maine is a different state. They have a lot of independents. They have a big independent streak. The other senator is who took over as an independent. I'm blanking out on his name right now, after Olympia Snowe retired.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, she would still be formidable. But the question is whether or not she wants to stick around and, you know, be part of, you know, the mess that is D.C. Olympia Snowe, the reason she stepped down, she said it was entirely toward, you know, the hyper-partisanship.
Yeah.
I mean, she was just done with it.
So Kavanaugh is he gets through the Senate. He is confirmed. Trump gives, at his swear-in, Trump basically gives a speech apologizing to Kavanaugh about the treatment that he has received during this. And Trump comes out and basically said he was proven completely innocent of these charges. And again, I think for me, it's why. What is the political calculation that you make that speech?
It's doubling down. So he does that when he sees himself as winning. Everything's viewed as a win.
Yeah, I won. Now I'm going to take a victory lap.
Right. It's personal. And so, he's going to rub it in the faces of his opponent. So I think that's what that was all about. You know, is really, because no longer does he have to try to play neutral or try to play nice and understanding. Remember, there was that whole brief window before he went on the attack against Ford, which I think so many people found appalling.
Very brief window.
Yeah, very brief window where he said that,
like, 6 days.
Right. You know, that these were, you know, serious allegations and needed to be investigated. Everybody was like, oh, that doesn't sound like him at all. It wasn't him.
It wasn't for a very short time.
Again, that was just calculated to kind of hold his fire. And then when he didn't need to hold that anymore, he could let out how he really felt. Is how he really feels.
So you mentioned winning and losing, and I think almost everything politically now that we talked about,
it's all in that context.
We talk about who won, who lost. So to me, there's three bodies we can talk about winning and losing. One is the Supreme Court itself, mm-hmm. and two is the Democrats, three is the Republicans.
Right.
So let's take the Supreme Court itself. How do you think... I certainly don't see how anybody could say this was a win for the Supreme Court as a governing entity.
Well, I think as an institution, I think it's going to cause even more people to question something we've talked about ad nauseum, you know, term limits, you know, around, you know, these lifetime appointments and the impact it has. It's also going to have a significant impact on questions involving the executive branch and presidential authority that come before Kavanaugh, because even more so after this whole debacle is the viewpoint that he owes his
nomination
to Trump. And then also the comments that he made when he, you know, unloaded on the Democrats and, you know, very hyperpartisan comments. And so, you know, there's going to be question to his, you know, his fairness, you know, on the bench.
If something gets to the Supreme Court about Trump, should Kavanaugh recuse himself?
You know, I think there's a strong case to be made for that now. And I think that there will be a lot of people calling for that. And I think that particularly on, you know, there are already the issues where he's come out so strongly for presidential authority, which already made that problematic. It's even more problematic now. The fact that you have that whole photo op, right, where Trump was, you know, bemoaning what happened to him and his family. And, you know, it's just, it makes it even more personal. I don't see how he doesn't on some of these matters recuse himself. Anything directly involving the president, I would think he would have to. If it's much further removed, there might be some wiggle room there.
But you take that, what you just said, and then you couple it with his performance during his hearing, where he basically attributed all of this to some sort of Clinton leftist conspiracy. To me, that's enough to say you can't. If we get to the charges about Trump and it's something in regards to his presidency, it's kind of inside that inner ring.
He can't. He would have to recuse himself.
There's no way he can sit on the court.
Yeah.
Keegan came out and said these types of confirmation processes, it really puts the court in a bad situation, because above all else, we need to be viewed as impartial. And with now with Kavanaugh on the court and the 51 vote and what went through, we don't have many more of these left in us that the Supreme Court can maintain that veneer of we're just an impartial constitutional arbitrator.
Right.
And I think that's really, really scary.
That is scary. And that's a keen insight. And it's even more relevant when you look at the docket before the court. Yeah. I mean, the first cases he's going to rule on. If you look at, you know, the handling of, you know, undocumented immigrants.
Which are the first things up to shoot tomorrow, Friday. Right. They start getting into it.
There are so many of these cases in limbo that involve the executive branch. I mean, and if you look at what's coming down the line, it's the, you know, the vast majority that's going to come before them, because so much is being litigated in terms of what the Trump administration has proposed or rules that they put in place. So, I mean, it's, you know, it's going to be tested pretty quickly on his end. I do want to jump back for a second, because we talked about Susan Collins and political ramifications for her. You know, the flip side of that is for Lisa Murkowski, there are conservatives that are irate with her and talking about challenging her in a primary, which will be interesting. And for those of the listeners that don't know, Lisa Murkowski has an interesting political history, because she was beat in the primary by Joe Miller, who was a Sarah Palin endorsed Tea Party candidate. And she ran as a write-in candidate statewide and ended up winning. It's one of only like less than five statewide writing campaigns that have ever won in history and in our country. And the fact that she has a long and difficult name, it was even more surprising that she was able to mount that bid and win.
That's interesting, because you have to spell her name correctly or it doesn't count. So she got more people to write in Murkowski correctly, which it would have to be right in front of me, or I have to write it on my hand for me to do that. And she still beat.
And she still beat Joe Miller. So I think that's a testament to her popularity and independence as well.
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, Trump came out and said, you know, well, she'll regret that. She's in jeopardy now. And Mitch McConnell said, I can tell you straight out, ain't nobody going to beat her in Alaska.
No.
If she won under the circumstances that you just described, she's safe.
Yeah, and I have a friend in Alaska who I was sharing articles with her, because the Alaska Republican Party, they're considering like a censor motion, or, you know, criticizing her publicly with like some type of motion of condemnation, you know, which again, they can do all they want. That has no impact on her ability. She's not going to be removed from any committees, anything like that.
Not at all.
That's not going to happen.
Mitch McConnell is not going to go on some sort of vendetta against her.
I mean that only hurts him, and it only hurts her and the state.
Yeah. So the Supreme Court, as a governing body, an institution, they're solid in that this was a loss for them.
Right.
There's no other way. Nobody can make an argument that doesn't ring true. Let's go now to the Republicans. And let's keep this in the context of the midterms. Does this help? Does it hurt? What actually does this do on November 6th when we vote? How does this propel Republican candidates forward? Does it depress the vote? What is the outcome of this for Republicans?
So a couple of things. I think that Republicans firmly believe this helps them with their base. And I think there's probably anecdotal evidence. I think the question of whether or not that carries over to Election Day.
Yeah.
I think there's no question it carries over to Election Day and helps the Democratic base. I think that it's a little bit more fleeting for the Republican base. I think that there's more of an incentive if Kavanaugh would have lost for Republicans to turn out and say, you know, we're going to send a message and avenge Kavanaugh. There's less so that he was able to get through, because the fact is we still have, 3 weeks until Election Day.
Yeah, it's like 25 days.
That's
or something.
A long time.
In this cycle, it's forever.
You know, with a lot that could possibly happen before that. So, you know, and I think that, you know, with independents and with Democrats, I think there's more of a net positive in terms of who this motivates. Now, Republicans are saying that it's impacting the polling. If you look at actual races,
there's
a couple spikes here and there, but then there's also races that don't seem to be impacted by that either. I think it's kind of mixed, and I don't think that there's any kind of universal bump.
So I love I know you love it when I ask you these types of questions, but I frame them up in a way that I only try to get the answer that I want. So I'm making an attempt at that again.
Okay.
You are the king of the Republican Party. Everything the Republican Party, you dictate and you decide. You are the one, you're the head honcho of that group. Have you just said, we're just giving up on women in the immediate future? We're not even going to try. What is your message to your candidates that are running in the midterms about how they should approach the female voter who voted for Trump but also was educated white suburban women? Are you just saying we're out of that? We're just let it go. We're not going to get it. Do you still feel that there's a message there towards women? Or if you had to write this is how we're going to approach this, what
would
that be?
Well, I mean, the circumstances are bad enough. I think if you don't even try, I mean, you're basically giving up, which is probably, you know, probably doesn't make much of a difference. But I think that if I were deciding and putting on my strategist cap, I would have an economic message that's focused on, you know, employment, try to, you know, run numbers on women who are employed versus, you know, and how that's changed, and income, median income numbers, being able to frame in the context of what that means in terms of local growth that, you know, in different metropolitan areas.
So you'd go scientifically at it. You would try to prove scientifically that Republicans are good for women in office, because under Republican leadership, under this iteration of it, women have made gains across the board.
Employment gains, better able to provide for your families. Yep. You know,
as more and more women are single parent providers, you're making the logical and the economic argument.
Yeah, I do not think outside of that economic argument there's much to make anywhere else. So that's really the only argument that you can make.
You're taking all the culture stuff and say, you know what, we're just not going to run that water.
No, because you can't win on
laser focus on it. Whenever you're in front of a women's group or you're speaking to a group and women's issues come up, we want to stick economically how we support women in economic terms, advancing that way, and that's your core message.
Absolutely. I mean, the Republican Party already abdicated all of those other issues. I mean, they've already, you know, when it comes to women. So everything that has transpired over the past 12 months and with Trump as the face of the party, you can't win on those issues. So, I mean, that's really all that's left.
So I heard a rumor, and I don't know if this is true or not, but somebody told me that the Republicans have pulled financial support for Yoder in the third.
It has happened. So
that has happened. Okay.
So their National Republican Campaign Committee, which is the funding arm of House Republicans, has pulled support. So they announced that, I think it was a week ago, last week. And so there was a Hill article out about that too, and made numerous publications. And so that's pretty much a signal. I mean, that they, part of it is they don't have enough money to go around. There's so many seats they have to defend, but it's also a signal that they're starting to give up hope. I mean, the last public poll that was out showed Sharice Davids up by
six or seven points.
Six to seven. So that's substantial. And I think that, you know, the NRCC has decided there's probably money that they could best spend elsewhere. I mean, they have seats that are right there on the line that they have to.
And I saw that too. They've taken a lot of those suburban districts that Clinton won, and they're assessing kind of what their opportunity is, and they're pulling money out of those districts, thinking because there's other places to go.
Right. And so, you know, that's a dynamic there. You know, and so the third congressional district is kind of an interesting case study because Kevin Yoder's opponent, Kevin Yoder's been a prolific fundraiser. Yeah. I mean, he holds key positions on different committees, you know, and so he's been able to use that to his benefit. But despite that, his opponent has been able to raise massive amounts of money and more than match him. And actually, in these last remaining weeks, I mean, there's been an avalanche of direct mail, you know, TV ads. I've been getting the mail, even as a Republican, you know, from the Kansas Democratic
You're
Party.
You're not marked correctly in the database.
Apparently not. I'm getting all of the mail, but it's interesting. And of course, I geek out over it. So I keep a file with all these, you know, cool mailings. I'm
so like, you tweeted me this week with that article that was local to Kansas City. Where the one Republican district captain or something, precinct captain, basically said, we're going to send that lesbian woman back to the reservation.
Yeah. I mean, so he basically responded in a Facebook message to a local Democratic Party leader, and he addressed her by referring to her as Little Miss Pritchett. So her last name is Pritchett. So okay. Little Miss. So when you begin a message like that.
Already off to the wrong start.
Right. And then he referred to Charisse Davids as a radical lesbian.
Yep.
Again, I'm paraphrasing.
Yeah.
Socialist who was going to get beat down by Kevin Yoder and set packing back to her reservation.
And like Charisse Davids is, she's American Indian too.
She is. Yeah. So, she's American Indian. So a lot of historic first, you know, as far as her candidacy for this district. So that precinct,
not from that gentleman's perspective.
No. So that precinct committee man, by the way, the Star article was a little bit disingenuous. The headline referred to him as a GOP official. You know, precinct committee people are elected. Yeah. The party doesn't pick them. They really
they're downstream.
They're quite, super quite downstream. Away. I mean, they, you know, they get to vote on the county party leadership, but that's about it. But I think people see the term GOP official and they think somebody who's involved in the state party or, well, you know, pulling the strings.
I had a weird debate with somebody who said, well, you know, Democrats are trying to make hay with that and they really shouldn't because it brings more attention to it. It highlights the Republican messages of her differences and that she is kind of in that Bernie Sanders socialist abolish ICE theme. And they think that Democrats think that going out and holding that up and saying, look, and you know, this is what the GOP thinks about our candidate, that's a mistake.
Oh, it was this was a complete gift to
the
Democrats.
I think that's a huge gift that if you're a Dem, she wins if massive amount of women turn out to vote for her.
Right.
And there is, if you read that, as you paraphrase that through, you know, and my sample size for all female politic reaction is my wife, just line by line, it couldn't be more offensive.
And
then the picture of her too. She looks angry. She looks mad. I think women will respond to that negatively on all kinds of different levels.
Well, and you know, all women. I mean, there's moderate Republican women too.
They're going to hate that.
They're going to hate this. And I think keep in mind that the Yoder campaign has held several focus groups with moderate Republican women to gauge their you know, reaction during the course of the campaign. And the takeaway that's I've heard referred, you know, from very credible sources over and over again is that moderate Republican women are very turned off when, you know, the conservatives in the party try to highlight her identity. You know,
absolutely.
And that they see that as a total turnoff and it makes them less likely to want to vote, you know, for the Republican. And so this plays right into that. And the fact of the matter is the third district is filled with moderate Republicans.
Absolutely. It's filled with suburban women.
Right. You know, this was a district that, you know, Kathleen Sebelius won when she ran for governor. It's voted Democrat several times. And so you have those moderate Republicans and you can't afford to turn them off to having them not vote or vote for Charisse Davids.
Yeah.
And if you lose their votes, and even if they don't vote for the Democrat, it's still a loss because, you know, you can't afford that in a high Democratic turnout year.
I've always had a political crush on Catherine Sebelius, too. Somebody asked me the other day, why wouldn't Catherine Sebelius, why isn't she a viable Democrat on the national stage? And it's, well, because she's too tied to Obamacare. Just no way.
The way that went down, that
they would
fiasco.
Pound her. So winners and losers for the Republicans, I'd say you're like a 51% L, not a big loss,
yeah,
but because again, the all of the issues that you have, and that Trump has created most of these around how the Republican Party is viewed by women, I don't think there's any way you can say that's a victory for us.
Not at all. It was there were moments that were extremely tone deaf, by Republican leaders and how that was handled. And looking back, I mean, having, female prosecutor, looking like that,
optics are terrible.
Yeah, there were so many bad moments. So you don't come out of that winning. But the problem is we've become so, hyper-partisan that, people just stick to their sides. And so the base is happy with what it turned out. And it's this whole, calculation of who won.
If you're a 51% L, I would say the Democrats were a 51% win.
Yeah.
Certainly this was not a moment to be proud of on the Democrat side. I don't think by any stretch of the imagination.
No, I think in looking back, the way this was handled from the very beginning, and again, that doesn't have anything to do with the allegations themselves, but it does sour, people on the entire process, using it for political gain rather than, legitimate, hey, this is, something that is, very serious and, needs to, be factored in. And the problem was, on both sides, most of the senators were asking questions that were predisposed to their own biases.
Absolutely.
Just to make their, point. And there wasn't any indication that there's anybody that's legitimately interested in just knowing the facts.
Well, if you go back to the first hearing with Cory Booker's Spartacus moment,
yes.
And then he's going to release emails which are nothing. There was nothing there. Kamala Harris, the other Democratic, wonder child right now, talking about, do you know this person from this law firm? Again, offering up some sort of weird conspiratorial, I'm going to get you question that there was absolutely
grasping
nothing
at straws at that point just to find
this is
something.
Even before we got to Feinstein and holding this. What's difficult for me is the fact that she held it doesn't impact the allegation.
No, that's
and
true.
But I do agree that in retrospect, and I think if she had to do this again, she would have dropped it. Or she would have convinced her to come forward earlier and we could have started this process in a totally different way. Because of the way she handled it, it gave the Republicans all they needed to rail against this and to make this not about the allegations against Kavanaugh, but to make this a due process argument. And there's a lot of due process argument to make.
So
I think again,
because in the allegations themselves, anytime that Republicans were questioned on those, they would just deflect to the way it was the entire process was handled. It became a procedural issue.
So it doesn't hurt with our base in any way. It doesn't alienate women. I don't think. Does it motivate people to vote, to get out and vote? Maybe. But the two blocks of people that we need to vote are the historical ones that turn out the least, youth and African-American vote. What did this do in any way to rally that? I'm not 100% sure it does or what impact it has.
And I think, again, both sides, I think, kind of shoot themselves, during this process. And something that happened, it was interesting. I think Phil Bresden, who's running for Senate in Tennessee against Marsha Blackburn.
Well, he's out now because Taylor Swift endorsed.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, once T. Swift gets involved, it's over.
But, speaking of the youth turnout, it looks like, she may have had an impact there if you look at the spike in voter registrations that occurred nationwide and then just in Tennessee due to her announcement. But the Democrats, he was asked about what he would do, on Kavanaugh. And he said he would still vote to confirm him. Now, keep in mind, he's running a very conservative state and has a tough hill to climb. Well, there were a lot of these Democratic organizations that came out, like Act Blue, and said, we'll never support him now, not one dime.
Which is ridiculous.
Which, again, is ridiculous. And so you have this overreaction. And so, again, it's a failure to look at the big picture. It's like, if you really want to have a seat at the table and be effective, you can't afford to just completely, disavow moderate Democrats who are trying to win in these states. I mean, you can't.
The thing I liked about what I heard the most out of this whole process, which there wasn't a lot to like, and it comes from Lindsey Graham, who Lindsey didn't really.
Oh, what a performance. Yeah.
But he said something interesting in the middle of his rant. Hey, tell Keegan and Sotomayor hi when you get there, because I voted for him too. That it was a point that kind of resonated, that as a Democrat, I would tell my constituents, I am not against voting for a conservative justice. Mm-hmm. That's not a criteria for me not to vote for you, but here are the things that I won't support. And I didn't hear a lot of that out of the Dems. Nobody really made the argument other than it's Kavanaugh, it's Trump, he owes Trump. Nobody really said, this is when I vote for a judge, this is the filter I put this through, and this is where Brett Kavanaugh doesn't meet my standard to vote.
Well,
it all just turned into yelling and fighting. And
well, I think that's where the Democrats lost credibility with those that are on the conservative side or independently minded, because I think many felt like, well, this was in the bag. They were going to vote against him anyway, and now they were just looking to hang on to something, and this is it. And so it's that made it more difficult to have a serious discussion about these allegations, because the thought was that, well, you know, he's conservative and the Democrats are going to oppose him based on that. And many of them had already come out and opposed him. And so, you know, that they're not open in terms of that in the first place. But there's an argument to be made there, because if you look at some of the Democratic nominees, they were approved by pretty substantial margins.
Yeah. I mean, I went back and looked at that, and
I
think Keegan got like 68, Sotomayor got like 59 or something. So in today's day and age, that's a massive majority at this point.
Right. I feel like, again, that's not going to happen. We're not going to see numbers like that. And we're definitely not going to see numbers, again, if you go back to the 90s, where justices were approved, like, you know, 90-7 or 93.
You said the other day Scalia was 98-0.
Wasn't
it Scalia?
I think it was Scalia,
And he had some real issues, Scalia.
Right. The only close one going back before Obama was president was Clarence Thomas, 52-48 for obvious reasons. But if you look at all the justices before and after, and you know that time through the 90s and early 2000s, I mean, they were all substantial. They were all 80s, 90s.
And I think what Democrats need more than anything right now is core messaging to what we stand
for.
Even
Roberts was approved 77 to like 22.
What do we stand for other than hating Trump?
Right.
And I think people kept waiting for something to come out of this that could codify that message, and it never did. It just shone the light more on, to your point, if you're the R and I'm the D, you're out. I'm just not voting for anybody or anything like this.
So that reminds me, the former Clinton advisor, what's his name? I can't recall his name. It'll come to me. He was a strategist, worked with Clinton. He has his own, I think.
Papadopoulos? George? No, not Papadopoulos.
No, Clinton.
Stephanopoulos.
Not Stephanopoulos. No, not him. Another guy. Anyway, he has his
Carville.
Own. Not Carville, not him. I want to say it's Doug something. Anyway, so he had an article on The Hill where he was commenting on the fact that he thinks that the resistance is doing more damage to Democrats in the long run, because that's not a message that people can coalesce around, that they need to have, again, what you and I have talked about, a very forward-thinking, forward-minded, you know, proactive messaging around, you know, what they're going to do and what they're going to change, and not just, we're anti-Trump, we're, you know, vote for us because of that.
Yeah.
And so his whole message around that was that the resistance has failed to develop anything that's cohesive and proactive. Yeah. And it's just been this, you know.
It's kind of like Occupy Wall Street.
Yeah.
We're pissed, but we really can't articulate what to do about it.
Default movement of those that are upset with what's happening.
And I want to be very clear. If I was a senator, I would have been a no on Kavanaugh for three issues. One, he chips away at Roe v. Wade. And I don't believe him that he thinks Roe v. Wade is settled law. And I believe that he dissents more than other judges. And I think he definitely puts Roe v. Wade in jeopardy. Mm-hmm. That'd be one reason why I wouldn't vote. Two was the fact of what you talked about, his opinions on presidential power. And we're going to enter a point of crisis mode here, or potentially, that we need all nine justices on the court fully functioning and able to hear cases.
Right.
Three, because there was a credible allegation against him. If he didn't have those two other things, I would have voted no on him just simply because there was a credible allegation of sexual assault. And four, after that performance at his hearing, he would definitely have been a no.
Yeah. If anything was going to make a difference with Susan Collins, it would have been, you know, that performance and how he reacted. Because
especially how he went over the woman from Minnesota, Klobuchar.
Oh, yeah.
Klobuchar. That would have been my cringy moment of, if I wasn't thinking it before, okay, I'll give you a pass maybe because you're angry and I get it, but that's a line I don't think I can come back from.
Yeah. I mean, it made the Clarence Thomas hearing seem tame by comparison.
So in the final analysis from us, there are no winners in this.
No.
There's only degrees of who lost more than somebody else.
Yeah. And I think, as a country, I think we lost overall. I think that we, you know, there's confidence in her, the Supreme Court has been lost, institutional confidence, Congress, I wouldn't be surprised if polling for Congress and the Supreme Court is down after this. I think it was a loss for everybody involved.
And to top this all off and bring this all to a bow, Mitch McConnell, in an interview, when asked, if another justice position comes open in 2020, will you invoke the Merrick Garland rule and not fill it during an election year? Nah, I wouldn't say that.
Yeah, he wouldn't commit.
What do you talk, Merrick Garland rule? I don't even know what you're talking about. I hate Mitch McConnell, but I got to admit, if he was on my team, I'd kind of have this weird respect for him because Mitch McConnell is going to get things done. He doesn't care what damage he causes, what wake of destructions he leaves in his path.
No, and his reasoning continues to change or evolve, yeah. I guess, on Merrick Garland.
Which evolve. That's a good one. It's evolving.
It's evolving.
Yeah, it wasn't evolving at the time that they could have gave Merrick Garland hearing.
No, it's very convenient. God, that
would have been so interesting to see how they would have handled that.
Oh, yeah.
Because there's no argument you can make that Merrick Garland is not qualified to be on the Supreme Court.
Oh, no. Completely qualified.
Well, I think for as long as we do this podcast, I'd be totally happy if there was never another Supreme Court nomination process. Seal those people up, what's the word you put them in? I can't say the word. Chronological freeze. That's not right. And just thaw them out when they just keep them there.
Cryogenically freeze.
Thank you. After that, and what it feels like is going to happen on the next one, because the next one is going, if it's Ginsburg, I don't know how we survive that.
Yeah. Well, we're very close to seeing that happen. And if we thought, things broke down, civility broke down this time, we haven't seen anything yet.
So let's move on to more interesting things and fun things to talk about. Nikki Haley resigning from the UN.
Yes, kind of came out of nowhere, right?
Comes out of nowhere. There were all of the typical responses. Well, she said she only wanted to be there 2 years. She talked about at the beginning of the year that this would be her last thing. I don't believe any of that.
Yeah, I don't either. I think that she is very keen and very ambitious and very savvy, and I think she's weighing her next political move, and she wants to create distance with the president.
I think so, too.
And with what may be coming down the pike. And so if there's ever time to separate yourself from what's going to drop, do it now, right? So that's her thinking.
In the list of C players that Trump has surrounded himself with, especially in his cabinet, Nikki Haley is by far head and shoulders above the best political operative, the savviest, and I think she just kind of read the tea leaves a little bit and said, we talk about this, maybe Trump's not even there in 2020. Why should she wait 2 more years if she's got a chance at 2020?
Right. And I think that's probably a smart calculation. I mean, she is already being referenced as a candidate by many kind of top presidential prospect. So if she's weighing her options now, this is the best time to get out, start building up that base, start making those visits to Iowa, New Hampshire, get out in front.
Nikki Haley, if I have my facts right here, she was born in India, or her parents were born
her
in India.
Her parents were, yeah.
So she's a Indian descent. Female migrant from India who won the governorship of South Carolina.
Right. You can't classify her as a migrant, but she's...
Her parents were migrants.
Her parents were, yeah. So she's...
So that's no small feat.
Of all states, South Carolina. Remember South Carolina's history, too.
I think South Carolina, did they still have the Confederate flag over the Capitol when she took office?
They did, and that's the other thing. She presided over the removal of that and gave a very, to this day, highly regarded, passionate speech about why South Carolina needed to move into the next century and why the flag needed to come down.
So this is a non-white woman who won the governorship of South Carolina at a time that the Confederate flag flew over their capital.
Right.
If you don't think she's got the intelligence, the savvy, and the moxie to get to the presidency, you are vastly underestimating Nikki Haley.
Yeah.
If I'm Trump or Trump's followers, that kind of is a little bit of a pucker moment of Trump, there's no way Trump could fight off Nikki Haley. That's an unfair fight on multiple fronts.
Right. And she's highly regarded by the party's base, yet she's pragmatic. You know, it's interesting, when she was governor, she fought back an effort by Republicans in her legislature to implement a Brownback style tax cut program.
Yeah.
Because she knew it was unsustainable, and even pointed to Kansas as an example. Yeah. So, you know, she's smart, she's savvy, she's well-liked, she's pragmatic. You know, she appeals to independents and to those in the middle. So she is very formidable as a candidate. And if I were her, I mean, she has to be thinking, you know, I've been able to hold this position and add to
with no help from the White House.
Right.
I've been able to make a go of this with no help
from Trump. Yeah.
You know, 180 reversals in policy, just idiotic performances to allies.
Oh, she's been blindsided numerous times.
She
and
has
undermined.
Been the one that's held that together.
Right.
Yeah. I two big fears. Well, number one, as a Democrat, you fear Nikki Haley on a national level. In a national election, Nikki Haley could be a formidable opponent. And then second, more practical terms, who's replacing her? It's not going to be somebody of her of her caliber.
It won't be.
I mean, we briefly talked to Ivanka because President said she would be the most qualified person to take that role. Let me just say that again. Ivanka Trump, this is directly from the President of the United States, that Ivanka Trump would be the most qualified person to be our UN ambassador. Brandon, kick that water out for me.
Well, the best I can come up with is that she does have apparel and jewelry lines.
She has high-end retail experience.
Has distributors in other countries. So
very
there's
true.
Foreign policy
very true.
Right there, right?
Yes.
So she's got to play well, you know, with her distribution lines.
So the sadist in me wants that to happen. I want him to nominate her because she has to go through a Senate confirmation process. What would that look like? The awesomeness, because they would start asking her questions about her business, her family business. I mean, there's no way that could happen. But just to, that's the first thing Trump talks about, replacing somebody the caliber of Nikki Haley with his daughter is, again, just ridiculous.
But again, it points back to, I mean, the whole nepotism argument. I mean, you have, you know, Jared Kushner and Ivanka Trump, who have been advisors, you know, and you know, Jared Kushner, who's supposedly supposed to broker Mideast peace, despite not having any background in foreign
policy. How about when Haley called Jared, oh, damn it, I'm going to get this wrong. No, an undiscovered genius. I think I've got that line right. Like, he's
right.
The undiscovered genius.
I laughed out loud when I was reading that.
But while that line is atrocious, it goes to her savviness of while you're sitting next to Trump, she knows exactly what to say to him. And she's already talking about, I'm going to be campaigning for Mr. Trump in 2020. I would be stunned if that happens. But she's savvy enough to know where she is, what she needs to do. And I would be surprised. I think she'll go on the speaking tour. I don't think she's going to write a tell-all book. Or if she does, it's going to be very much like Barack Obama's Audacity of Hope, something inspirational about her story.
It's going to be something where she can package herself for the presidency.
There's enough substance to Nikki Haley that she doesn't have to write some cheap knockoff tell-all to get attention.
Right.
And I think that's what separates her from everybody that's left the Trump administration
to this point. She's not somebody like Omarosa, who's, you know, just trying to, you know, keep her brand alive as long as possible. I mean, she has skills, she has savvy, she has experience, and she's ambitious and, you know, and is a candidate potential that, you know, the Republicans don't have elsewhere. I mean, she's kind of on an island in terms of what she brings to the table.
So you mentioned October. Let's talk about October surprises. We were texting today or the other day saying, you know, hey, there's 25, 26 days left to the election as we record this. Does anybody not think there are multiple people out there holding some cards that they're going to play prior to the midterm?
Oh, I would think so. Again, it's opportune moments, right?
Absolutely.
And we're in that period now. We're just waiting to see what drops. You know, and it's interesting, it dropped early, and I think did not get the exposure it would have because of being in the midst of the Kavanaugh hearings. But the New York Times story about Trump's wealth, the investigation that was into the, you know, whole money scheme with the passing down of wealth by his father. So that whole idea that, you know, he got this $1 million loan, turns out that's not the case.
That's a huge non-story. I mean, to me, that's sun's hot, water wet. Hey, Trump lied about his finances. He got most of his money from his dad. I'm still waiting for what's the revelation here.
Well, yeah, it's not a great, I mean, it's not a huge revelation, but again, it I think if there was any doubt that Trump is all about marketing an image of himself that's sure. not based on reality, it just, you know, it feeds into that. So this whole idea of savvy businessman on his own, creating an empire, none of it is true.
No.
I mean, he was basically helped every step of the way. He did nothing on his own. He's had numerous bankruptcies.
And wait a minute, Brandon, as an American, you're telling me that rich Americans manipulate the tax system to generate generational wealth for their families? I'm stunned.
I
can't.
It's not eye-opening at all.
That was a whole joke. To me, what aggravated me about that story, that was the New York Times just patting itself on the back. Look at this big investigation we did. For what? Well, what's the outcome of that? I was actually more turned off by that and more turned off at the Times that you would invest those types of resources. Did you get his tax returns? No.
No.
What's the point? I thought that was just a huge East Coast media rubbing one out session. I didn't understand any of why that was even done or why the media made such a big deal about it.
Well, that's kind of true. I think without the context of it and, you know, connected to anything else, it doesn't. So I was waiting for there to be a follow-up or something that we could be able to latch onto and say, oh, okay.
If that was step one of a three-part story,
right.
That's a good setup. But I think at the end, that's just a huge amount of nothing.
But speaking about the tax return, I don't know if we've talked about this on here, but if Democrats can gain control of the House, there's a little-known law that they can exploit to force him to reveal his tax returns.
Yeah.
So that's interesting.
So I think my candidates for October surprise, Omarosa releases a tape of Trump saying the N-word.
You know she has more.
She said she has like 200 more because she's been silent for
six weeks.
Quiet. That's not her style.
No.
So that's one. Tom Arnold digs up some Apprentice tape and drops that of Trump saying something horrible. All of my October surprises get to more of the sensational, more of the, hey, you know, we've been hearing about all of this potential stuff that could surface, that somebody might try to surface one of those things during October.
I would not be surprised to see more leaks out of the White House, too, at a greater volume, and maybe something more substantial, too.
The op-ed writer comes, makes themselves, steps forward.
Since that story's been quiet, I mean, they could,
what if it's Nikki Haley? would be... That would be a big one.
That would be extremely significant. Yeah, that would be a huge bombshell.
Okay, enough with the tapes. Election. That's the one I want to happen. what can the Republicans do in the October surprising? What would it be? Y'all hate Hillary Clinton and think she should be in jail. Known.
I mean, I don't know. The problem is the Republicans control everything. So, I mean, any October surprise has limited impact because... You know, where does it go? I mean, it doesn't, they're in terms of ramification or consequence, there's nobody to remove from power or to, you know, have resign or step down. It's in a presidential election. They're not, you know, opposing a presidential candidate on the Democratic side.
And I'm trying to think of the right word, that we're more susceptible, I think, to October surprises and the information age,
social media,
and we're kind of all geared for it too. We're all kind of waiting. We're expecting for this to happen. So if you are somebody who simply just wants to push an agenda with something sensational, this is your time to shine. I mean, there's no better one than this. The last October surprise with Comey and the email and that was, I don't think anybody could make an argument that did not have a negative impact on Hillary Clinton.
Oh, it absolutely
did. Which again turned out to be a big nothing, but as an October surprise, as a definition of something you spring on people late in the game to sway their vote, that was about as good as it gets. I'm hoping we get something of equal value just for sheer entertainment purposes at this point.
Yeah, and I think there's enough floating out there, and there's enough loose ends that are in the process of being connected with that we could see that.
Yeah,
whether it's internal from the administration or we see it leaked out from elsewhere.
Yeah,
so that's
So let's wrap up our hour since we had an extended period since the last one. We were talking, we started talking and we got about to the eighth most ridiculous thing we've heard in the past 2 weeks. It's like, let's just talk about this live.
Yeah.
Just absolutely things that made you shudder, shake your head. I'll go first.
Okay.
When did I would like to know, and maybe we could do this. Maybe this is Trump's post-presidency reality series. When did he and Kim Jong-un fall in love? Can I see some of the letters? Is this romantic love? Is this bromance love?
He said it was beautiful love.
It was beautiful. So Kim Jong-un, who is one of the worst human beings, worst dictators on the planet.
Mass murderer.
Mass murderer. He spent family members to dogs. He keeps people in concentration camps for life. Somehow he wrote a letter to Big Don, and those two started a correspondence that kind of like two high school kids would back in the 80s. They'd Snapchat it now, but back when letters were in vogue, he literally said, "We fell in love." I'm not paraphrasing.
No, that's his actual
I'm not overstating
words,
to dramatically make my point. He said he fell in love with the North Korean dictator.
I mean, you can't make this up. How does SNL parody that? Satirize that? You can't.
If we were SNL writers, and I'm like, Brandon, I got an idea for a skit, you'd say, that's too over the top.
Yeah.
Even that's too much for us. And once again, I'll whip on you, the one Republican here, radio silence out of your side.
Yeah.
Nobody says a word.
I guess that's what's most frustrating is it gets ignored. You complete no attention brought to it, nothing.
I keep trying to backpack through history. If George W. Bush said he fell in love with the new prime minister of Iraq that they put in, if Ronald Reagan would have said, no, me and Gorby, we're in love. I just don't. There's no contact. So ridiculous.
Can you imagine if Barack Obama had said he was in love? I mean,
who would he be? Him and Putin fell in love,
right? I mean,
him and Kim Jong Il fell in love.
Republicans would be irate. They would be just they'd be impeachment proceedings. Like that's it. I mean, they would initiate those. It gets a shrug. It's like
and he does it in front of this rally crowd. And they all just kind of applaud. I mean,
he did get a lot of people, odd looks, like people that didn't know how to react.
He was like in Mississippi or something when he said that.
Yeah.
It's your turn. What's one of your ridiculous ones?
Okay. Maybe I'll give two. Well, so we had talked about this offline, but Kanye West at the White House today.
It's Ye now, right?
Oh, that's right.
I think Ye. He changed his name just to Y-E, to Ye.
Yeah. Official White House meeting, with pulling out all the stops and photographers there, everything. So, yeah, there's that. So there's that bromance that's also happening simultaneously. So feel bad.
I wonder if Kim Jong-un's going to get jealous.
Yeah.
He's going to write him a letter. You've already got one man love in your life. You cannot have two. That's just bad. You can't do that. Come on.
And Trump gets all three of them together and they work out, world peace, right?
Yeah. I thought you were going to say three-way.
I know that's what you're going to thought.
I would have said that, but Brad, I knew you were going to go all that way.
I'm going to let you make that insinuation.
But here's where again, the Republicans are supposed to be the traditionalist and standing on tradition and their acceptable behaviors.
The adults in the room.
My side's supposed to be the hippie liberal screaming mob right now, which in some ways we are. But I thought there were rules to who you gave access to an Oval Office visit, especially an Oval Office visit on camera.
Yeah.
I thought that was head of state, head of party, civil leader. I didn't think Kanye West crossed any of those barriers to warrant a sit down face to face in front of the media with the president.
Well, I mean, all of the rules are, out the window. I mean, this president, his overarching concern is people who like and love him and who speak well of him. And so those people get an elevated platform, and so Kanye West gets to, bring the issue to him about, African-American, disenfranchisement and police relations that, any other person with that would it be able to get a hearing.
And he did drop an MF in the Oval Office too.
Oh, I did not hear that, did he?
Okay. He MF'd in the Mobile office. after telling Trump he loved him, he thought Trump was a hero. Trump's on his hero journey. Again, if you want to Google John Stewart and Bill O'Reilly have a debate when Barack Obama invited Common, who's another rapper actor, and the absolute losing his mind of Bill O'Reilly and Sean Hannity, because he went to Cuba and had a sit down with an American who was accused of killing a cop or something. And his position was he thinks this guy has been charged erroneously, that he didn't do it. And just how they melted down, that how dare you bring that man into the White House. There's just no defense for
this. Again, it's hypocrisy. I mean, there's no, you can't justify it. The other thing I want to highlight is article out today in the UK Independent.
You read all these European, you're supposed to rail against them as being socialist commies. I can't believe there's a Republican. That's why you're on all of these lists, because you subscribe to all that stuff.
The old Republican notion of the transatlantic alliance, NATO.
You really like Margaret Thatcher, didn't you?
I was a big Margaret Thatcher fan. But the point is, some of these European publications, whether you're talking about even like BBC or The Economist, I mean, you get, kind of unfiltered news that you don't get, stateside. So the UK Independent has some internal sources in the White House who have basically said that Trump has been trying to fire John Kelly for a long time, that basically indicated that he's upset with John Kelly, and John Kelly just ignores like his rants where he says, get out of here, I don't want you. So John Kelly is staying on and basically ignoring the president. But the other issue is that the president is dumbfounded because he doesn't know how to go about firing John Kelly, because there's nobody above John Kelly that he can go to register his displeasure. And so he doesn't understand the chain of command for next steps. So
he doesn't understand that he can just do it if he wants to. That John Kelly reports to him.
Apparently that was the whole gist of this article.
Firing people directly is not Trump's MO.
No, he hates to do that. Contrary to the image he's made of himself, he does not.
So what you're saying, there's no convenient person to say, go fire Kelly, that has the authority to do it.
Right.
And Kelly's just, I'm just ignoring you. You're not going
to
fire me.
He's just continuing to do his job.
Yeah. I'm just going to keep doing this and you're going to do nothing. And that's kind of this uneasy relationship that they've fallen into.
Right. Which is so bizarre. I mean, think about that happening in like a business, let alone in the White House of all places. I mean,
if you said that about any other presidency, I would say that's just a trash article and that's just clickbait. That's probably kind of true.
Yeah, I mean, this is a legitimate story. I mean, several sources cited, and it would not surprise me at all, just everything we know already.
How about when the UN report on climate change came out this week, to which Trump's words, and I'm paraphrasing here, I've seen a lot of climate reports. Some are really fabulous. Some aren't that very good. I guess I'm going to have to see who wrote this one before I believe it.
Because he, understands, who's who in the, among climate change scientists.
And number one, do you believe Trump's read any report on climate change? Absolutely not. He hasn't even sat for a bullet-pointed presentation on it by somebody.
Right.
And what he's basically saying now is, if it's a group that I agree with or aligns with me, I accept that as science. If they're not, I don't.
Right.
And I think we all knew that anyway, but just another horrible example of Trump's thought process, his narcissism.
He rambles without really saying anything. So that reminds me of one last one that I'm going to say. So this week with Hurricane Michael making landfall.
When did that storm? I mean, that was like a blip of rain on the radar.
Like blew up
and suddenly
this.
It's like there's a Cat 4 heading for Florida and everyone's going to die.
And I mean, most significant storm to hit the panhandle since like the 1850s. Yeah. Crazy. So Trump, instead of going to, I think they were going to go to Secretary of Homeland Security to get like a briefing update on preparations for the storm. So instead, the White House decides to hold this like photo op where she's in there giving a briefing to the president, and all the reporters are watching as the president's being briefed. He's at the Oval Office desk.
Kind of like an inaction shot.
Right, inaction, but he has these easels with like these, blown up satellite images.
No.
And so it's so bad. So during like this, and the show's like performance art by the president, he's used to, his reality show environment. Yeah. He just randomly, as she starts speaking to him, points very, over to one of those easels to the hurricane map, again, not when it's relevant to the discussion that's happening, and then, retracts his arm, and everybody's like, so what was that? Like,
so he's
for the cameras.
People, this is a hurricane.
This is a map.
This is the hurricane.
This is the hurricane.
About.
This is a map of Florida.
Oh, my God. God. just to show I'm following along with you, I'm pointing to the, it's just.
It was such a bizarro moment. And so those that are listening, you can Google that clip and find it on YouTube. I mean, it's, people have been watching it like crazy.
It's his thought process. Why do that? Because that to me, that's a point of where you're, I want to look presidential in front of this. Yeah. I'm listening earnestly. I'm asking some questions about the threat assessment. What are we doing for people on the ground? We're with the American people. I'm not pointing at, yes, I know what a hurricane looks like. Right. Or I know I can find Florida on a map. A story we need to follow this week and talk about it is the 58,000 registered voters in Georgia that have had their registrations challenged.
Yes, I've heard about that. I haven't heard the details. I gotta
read up on that a little bit.
I do too.
Because that could, 58,000, and most of these, I think, are young and African-American. With Stacey Abrams running down there, that could absolutely tilt that election.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's a super competitive race at the moment, that governor's race.
Yeah. Yeah, we'll try to stick to every week because you just get too long out.
In a 10-day
cycle, you can't digest it all. And I have a feeling this next three-week run to the midterms, the potential for a serious shit show is brewing. There's a hurricane gathering right now of people saying, is it time yet?
It's like a funnel cloud looming about to drop.
It's coming. Yeah. And it's just now, who's going to drop it and what are they going to drop?
Right.
I'm going to be so mad if we're sitting here like November 6th.
and there's nothing to talk about.
Yeah. Come on, Tom Arnold. You've been talking about these tapes for a year. You have a TV show about it. Okay, Omarosa, it's your time to shine. Let's go. Fire up that branding engine and get back in the mix.
Oh, exactly. I would think, the 15 minutes of fame alone would be enough to get some of these people to move forward.
I'm cheering for Tom Arnold and Omarosa. That's awful.
Welcome to 2018.
That's our hour. Thanks, Brandon.
Thanks.